Hey everyone, today's guest is Mark Tremonti, lead guitarist for the Tallahassee, Florida rock band, Creed. Together we break down the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the smash hit single, Higher, taken from their 1999 album, Human Clay. Talk about evading the sophomore slump. Creed came roaring back with the first single from their second album. Hot off the heels of their huge debut album, My Own Prison, it sounds like the band didn't have much time to think about anything except writing new songs. Mark explained that Higher was bored out of sound checks, where he recalls jamming the core of the song with the band, as Creed didn't really record demos back then. I enlightened Mark to some things about the song that he didn't even remember, such as producer John Kurzweg's involvement, playing the organ throughout most of the track. This contribution is not something you would probably hear if the song were playing in your car, a bar, or sporting event, but in headphones, it's there in all its glory, adding a killer element underneath the enormity of the song. Oh, and Mark just might be one of the hardest working guys in rock and roll. Mad respect. So for all this and a ton more, stick around, and let's get Higher.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. You have the honor of being one of the earliest guests. I don't like to ruin the illusion here. I like people to think whenever they're listening that this is live, but it's not. But yeah, you're up bright and early. I like that. I am too.
This is actually my second interview of the morning. So it's I started at 8 a.m. this morning.
I absolutely love it. Well, listen, I want to start off by saying congratulations. I've followed your career. I've known about Creed since you guys started because we were kind of next door neighbors. You guys were over in Tallahassee and less than Jake was over in Gainesville. So the story's pretty fascinating, but I want to start off by saying congratulations on the Creed reunion. This thing is just, you know, for one of the most hated bands, you guys were hated before Nickelback. You guys were the original OGs.
It was quite a time. You know, it seems like everybody's, you know, since the announcement, man, all it's just been pure love. So it's been great.
Well, that's awesome. And of course, you know, let's not discount Alter Bridge. And that's where I ran into you recently. We were doing festivals together. This band, I mean, look what you've accomplished there, what you've done with Tremonti. And then this is probably the fifth time I've told you this through text when I saw you. But the Frank Sinatra covers record that you did, Tremonti Sings Sinatra, released a couple of years ago with proceeds going to the National Down Syndrome Society. I can't believe that's you singing that. It sounds like something that was recorded back in the 50s or 60s. It's so cool.
Well, thank you. It was one of the most exciting things I've ever done in the studio. You know, working with those guys was nuts. You know, sharing the stage with guys that shared the stage with Frank Sinatra is just blowing my mind.
Use your mentality. Wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin.
How difficult, I mean, obviously you have some natural ability with that, but did they push you in the studio or did you just get and sing the songs a couple times and they did a vocal comp or?
No, you know, Mike Smith, who was Frank Sinatra's band leader for some time back in the day, he tried to direct me a little bit on the first song, but I think then he realized, all right, you know, you practiced. You know, he's like, you know, when the old man did this or did that, he would phrase it like this. I'm like, well, Mike, listen to what I'm referring to. I'm referring to this recording. He's like, okay, you got it, kid. You know what you're doing.
So you had actually studied recordings of his, not just, you know, you'd went maybe listen to live stuff.
Oh man, I'd listen to everything. I went on the deep dive. I wanted to make sure I knew everything about his approach, not only when he was an older guy, but from his early career. And I studied from start to finish everything I could. And I went online, a deep dive on trying to find people teaching you how to sing like Frank Sinatra. And everybody who does a lesson on how to sing like Frank Sinatra sounds nothing like Frank Sinatra. So I was like, you know, you got to do it yourself. You know, just listen. Just as a guitar player, you hear stuff and you're like, you know what? After a few years, you can hear if somebody's playing on a G string or a D string because of that wound string and that unwound string.
Right.
Same thing with a vocal. If you listen hard enough, you can hear the little placements of the voice. And all the little nuances.
Well, it's fabulous. For everyone listening, check that out. Tremonti sings Sinatra. It blew my mind. But, you know, getting back to the early 90s, I mean, there was some noise coming out of Tallahassee. There was this little band called Creed, and I was hearing about you guys. And I can't remember an old engineer at a studio in Gainesville. I don't know if you do. You remember Mike Rodolante? Does that name ring a bell?
I do not. No.
Okay, I think Mike did maybe sound for you guys. Maybe it might have been locally in Tallahassee for a little while. But there was this noise of this band, and then the next thing I know, this record comes out. And you had recorded the first album, My Own Prison, in John Kurzweg, the producer's house.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like in his bedroom or something, right?
Oh, yeah. We would. I was working at Chili's at the time. Scott Stapp was working at Ruby Tuesdays. Flip was, our drummer, was working at the a knife store at the mall. And then Brian, his father was a doctor, so he was rich, and he got to just go to school. But we put our monies together to pay, I think it was $30 an hour back in the time, to go to John Kurzweg's studio and recorded My Own Prison. And that was a lot of fun.
And look what that record did. Of course, it was remixed after it was initially released, but four singles from the album, My Own Prison, Torn, What's This Life For, and One, huge, massive songs. And I got to ask you, was there any, because I love the story here. You guys just, again, you were flipping burgers. You were a line cook. Mm-hmm. The next thing you know, you record this record in a bedroom. It's starting to blow up around Florida. Label comes sniffing, you get it remixed, and it just becomes, you know, what looks like this overnight sensation. Now you got to do the follow-up.
Oh, yeah.
Was there any pressure? Was there any thought of, oh, man, we have to repeat this?
Yeah, back in the day, man, the rock and roll world, when you're in it back in those days, was not rooting for you. Everybody's trying to give you hurdles and trying to chop you down. So from when we had our first single come out, My Own Prison, it went number one on the rock charts. And then everybody's like, you know, most bands have their one-hit wonders, and, you know, you better soak it in now because you're not going to be here tomorrow. And then we put out Torn, I think it was our second single, and that went number one. We're like, all right, we're still surviving. And then like, all right, well, maybe as your first record is great, but you're going to have a sophomore slump on your next record. And then we come out with Higher, and that's our biggest song at the time. So we just kept on, you know, having to prove ourselves year after year. And yeah, it's just the way of the world, man. People see some success and they're like, well, you're not going to be successful if you don't do this or don't do that. But I think at the end of the day, if you just keep your head down, work hard, and write songs that you believe in, other people are going to.
Well, and I got to tell you, by the late 90s, you remember everyone, Gene Simmons, rock is dead, rock is dead. And here you got a band like Creed that comes out. You know, I always stood up for you guys. I was like, there are four guys playing their instruments. They're not running tracks here. There's no DJ.
Yeah, it's funny. People would be like, yeah, Creed's a corporate band put together by, you know, record label. Like, what are you talking about? We're four dudes that met, you know, college and, yeah, I mean, I met Scott in high school, but we're just like any other four idiots in college that get in the band together and find some luck.
Well, a couple of things here. The record Human Clay was released September 28th, 99. It was preceded by the first single Higher by a month. Came out August 24th of that year. Interestingly enough, though, Mark, the track Higher was number 9 out of 11 on the record. Did nobody hear that as a single initially? That seems like it's buried.
Oh, no, we knew that was going to be a single. That was, I remember being in the studio for that. And it's so funny. When I listen back to that song, I remember the ADAT recorders. We recorded that.
Oh, yeah.
On ADAT. So when we were listening to the mix of that, you know, it's one of those things where you hear it played back. You're like, all right, this is a good one. We know it's going to, it works for what we do. I think it's going to, I think we knew it was the first single. I remember the first time hearing it on the radio, I was with my wife and we were buying furniture for our first home at, I forget where it was, but I remember hearing it on the radio and being pretty excited about it.
So of course you're excited about it. It's the next single, it's the next record, but you had already heard yourself on the radio. So you're still getting excited at that point. That's awesome.
I think what excited me was the DJ who played it. Like, wow, Creed's coming back, swinging for the fences with this one kind of thing. You know, they dug it. So when you hear it received so well, it was a good moment.
Well, that's when I kind of started to peek behind the curtains a little bit. I'm like, okay, this guy likes Maiden or something. This isn't, you know, because it was the guitar lick, the hook in this song and the choruses. And I remember hearing this song for the first time, like, man, this is pretty heavy. And for the next follow-up single, The Sophomore Slump, you guys hit it out of the park.
Yeah, we were, the entire time we were doing it, we were fighting for survival. You know, this is all we ever wanted to do. And I don't think it was until we did, I always felt like I was, you know, on the verge of not having a career anymore because of all the doubts and all the struggles. But once we hit Alter Bridge AB3 record, I was finally like, you know what? I've been doing it this long. I think if you just keep on keeping on and working hard, we can do this as long as we want. So it took that long to feel comfortable, you know, with this career.
Yeah, I don't care how many records anybody has sold, how many concert tickets. There's always that, am I going to be, I don't know if the word's relevant, but am I going to be doing this in a year?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's,
yeah.
I finally feel like with as many projects that I have going on, I could keep on going for quite some time, thankfully.
And again, was there any discussion of, and why was this track 9 out of 11? That does seem odd to me as a single. Usually that'd be the second, third, or fourth track on an album. Back then, people bought albums.
It's funny. I don't even remember the order of the records. You know, I remember, you know, My Own Prison, I think I could rattle it off pretty well. But as far as the other records, I don't know if I know the order anymore. Human Clay start with What If, maybe? I'm not sure.
Fair enough. I always joke on the show. It's not like we sit around and analyze and listen to our own records. I totally get that.
People ask me how to play certain songs. But I have no idea. I'd have to relearn.
Yeah.
I've got 18 records now. There's no way I'm going to remember even.
They're like, what do you mean you don't know how to play it? You wrote it. It's like, dude, I got 400 songs. You don't get it.
Yeah.
Real quick, John Kurzweg, engineered, produced, and mixed the track Higher. Of course, he's worked with you. You guys, you know, put him on the map. Is it safe to say he was kind of the fifth ingredient back in the day?
He was just an experienced guy. You know, we hadn't met anybody like that, you know, at the time. We were just surrounded by just college musicians. He was the only guy we knew in town that had a record deal in the past. I think he was signed to Atlantic Records back in the day.
Yeah, he put out a solo record in 87. I had seen when I was researching all of this. So yeah, he had this career, but you know, a lot of times the local guy that you know, he's not the greatest. He's just your buddy. And I mean, you stumbled across a pretty good find here.
Yeah, no, he was meticulous. What bummed me out is I'd be ready to get out of Chili's and go over to track my guitars. And I'd haul ass over there and it would be raining outside. And he's like, oh, we can't record today. You can hear the rain on the roof. I'm like, come on, dude, you can't hear the rain. He's like, no, we can't track today. So he was that meticulous. He did have like a steel roof so you could hear it a little bit, but it would, I don't think it would have mattered too much, but he took what he did very seriously, and he was a gentleman, and he was great.
That is really cool. Well, do you remember writing Higher? Was it after the first record? Was it on tour for My Own Prison? You guys were out, you were noodling with the riffs, or
the only thing I remember is messing around with it at soundcheck. You know, we used to do this thing where we would try to write songs in the moment. Sometimes in the early days when it didn't matter in college, we'd be like, all right, we're going to write a song with you guys on stage. All right, Mark, start playing a riff, and Scott would start singing over it. I think we were just on stage sound checking, and I was just playing the music to Higher, and Scott kicked out that chorus, you know, and it was just in the moment. And I think we were like, all right, we're on to something here. And that was kind of the birth of that song.
Were you demoing in these days? Is there a demo of Higher, or would you just get the parts together and then go jam them and get with John and pre-production, or how'd it come about that way?
No, we didn't really have super proper demos. We would record stuff here and there, but it was, we used to have a gentleman named Ron Renew that would follow us around with video cameras. So we have tons of old footage of us as kids in college just playing our first shows. It's funny. I just saw a video of us playing a full show at the place where we got our first record deal. And you would think that we were a metal band because the crowd's all moshing. It's college. Nobody knew who Creed was at the time. It was just we'd kick into a heavy riff and the whole place would go nuts. So it was the early days before anybody knew of us. So it's cool to see those. And there's a lot of songs I'd forgotten about that I'm like, you know, we could polish those things off and put them out someday. But
Was that at Floyd's, the Cowhouse? Where was that at?
Floyd's Music Store.
It was Floyd's.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's actually the same place I met my wife.
Very cool.
You know, and that had nothing to do with the concert. That was just me and my buddy were going to go pick somebody up. It was one of the bartenders that we were friends with. We're going to go grab him. And that's when my wife happened to be there.
That's awesome. And didn't they used to do shows on the campus? I think we played there a couple times.
We've played everywhere there, but I know we did, was it Fat Tuesdays where... Matchbox 20 got their record deal.
That's right.
Yeah, I was there that night where it was Matchbox 20. They were in there. I think they had a different name, Tabitha's Secret, I think it was called.
Yes.
And yeah, they were in there doing a showcase. And I think after that show, they got an offer. So I think I was at the show where they got discovered by label.
That's awesome. Well, we're going to jump into the track now, Mark. And I went ahead with the album version. You know, a lot of times I'll do the single version of a song that was big enough. And certainly I think at least as many people have heard the single version probably as the album version or more. But I went with the album version. I thought it was important here because, I don't know, I felt that the parts that were omitted were really cool. So I wanted to talk about them. The track is 5 minutes and 16 seconds, hence why they whittled it down a little bit for radio. It was a little bit long. The intro is these clean stereo guitars. The first thing we hear is the pickup note of the stereo guitar panned off to the right, followed by 8 bars of a moving riff in drop D before the band kicks in. Right here is where the radio edit. You omitted that first part, but this is where the song would have started. But I love the mood and the tone that creates. When the band kicks in, it's drums, bass, and big distorted stereo guitars join us for 8 more bars. And that riff from the top continues through for 8 more bars, but gets bigger there before we get into verse 1. I know that Scott wrote these lyrics, but I'm going to read these lyrics and we're going to talk about them a little bit. And there's a lot going on in verse 1 I want to talk about musically.
Yeah.
When dreaming, I'm guided to another world, time and time again. At sunrise, I fight to stay asleep because I don't want to leave the comfort of this place. Because there's a hunger, a longing to escape from the life I live when I'm awake. And you know, you guys got a lot of grief for being, having religious overtones, you know. And when I was a kid, I liked Stryper and Slayer just the same. My listeners know that. I've said that before. But these lyrics, they sound pretty positive to me. They sound like they're coming from a good place, you know. And religious or not, it just the song feels good. What does this verse mean to you?
To me, it's just escapism, you know. It's the being able to escape the tethers of normal life or the fetters of normal life and just going and being in your dream state where life is good. And when you wake up from a dream, sometimes you're like, damn it, let me get back to what it was. Cause now we got to go to work flipping burgers at Chili's.
Right.
You know, and speaking of the religious overtones, you know, one thing you got to say about Scott Stapp in general, still to this day is he caught a lot of grief. And as a band, you know, just a guilty by association thing, we would get the same thing. I never really took any offense to it whatsoever, but Scott, as much as he took heat for that, he never backed down from it, never changed his tune, it never affected him. He's like, I believe what I believe, and you got to respect him for that, you know.
Good for him. Well, yeah, and you know, it's especially when you're being thrown into the public light like you guys were at that point. I mean, this record sold 10 million copies. That's diamond certification. Not many bands do that.
Yeah. You know,
Michael Jackson, Def Leppard. I mean, these are, think about that.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty, you know, at the time we were kids, it seemed like, and you appreciate the hell out of it, but you don't really appreciate it as much as when you start another band called Alter Bridge and you see how hard that fight is to get the radio play, to get the record sales. And I've lived both sides of that fence. I've been in the band like Creed, where you have the huge amount of record sales and radio play, but you also have the critics and people lashing out at you. But then I've been in Alter Bridge, where it's tougher to sell as many records, but you have the critical acclaim. So I've gotten to see both sides of the fence.
Yeah. And just the fact that you've gotten where you've gotten with Altar Bridge. Not many people go outside of their bands and can, you know, it's very, very difficult. I've always said the band is the sum of its parts. But verse one, a lot of cool things. And I think you've already answered this question. This record wasn't done to Pro Tools.
No,
you did it on ADAT?
No. Oh, yeah, ADAT.
Mm-hmm. Oh, not even to take ADATs were a nightmare. Remember they used to have to chase each other, and it was just.
Well, I didn't know anything about it. I'm just sitting on the couch, and he say, "All right, ready? Here we go." I don't know how he put it together. I don't know how ADATs what the process was, other than sitting back there and just being excited.
Do you remember any primitive editing on a computer? Like after he would take the ADATs and dump them, and you wouldn't be able to do what you could do now, move vocals around, but you could move sections.
Yeah, I don't remember ever overdubbing anything. It was kind of like here's your take, and then you would just put it in. It was record whatever tone you got. It wasn't a second take. Whatever is clean, we're gonna hit that. Whatever's dirty, we're gonna hit that, all in one chunk, you know. And how it was shot, like you said, you take the first verse, and once it hits that pre-chorus or that chorus and it hits the dirty guitars, whatever the different tone sections are, that's what we would cut.
The dirties in this song, especially the chugga chuggas in the pre-chorus, and we're going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard a tone like these big stereo guitars in this particular track ever again.
Huh.
I know your tone, but there's something about this song that's just, these stereos are massive.
You know, I can't remember what amp I used either back then. I think I might've had one of those old Hughes and Kettner, before the Hughes and Kettner came out with the fancy lit up amp. There was one before, I think it was a Tax 100 or something like that. I forget. But I combined that with some other amp. I don't know what it was back in the day. I think this was before I could afford a Mesa Boogie rectifier.
Some of the craziest, biggest guitar tones are just swap and mix and match.
Yeah.
I know that. I've had guys on this show, it's like, yeah, I borrowed my buddy's amp last minute and I got this massive guitar sound, you know, and you try to replicate it again and you're like, you don't know what you did.
Oh, yeah. I was just watching something on the Kinks, and they were talking about when he recorded one of the first kind of heavy metal sounding guitars. He took an amp, a little amp that he bought, little Bluth, I forget the name of it, and he took razor blades and he cut away from the cone, and that sound made it sound like this overdriven kind of distorted metal tone. They say, you know, that's how he started to invent the heavy metal tones.
That is awesome. Well, verse one here, the big stereo guitars, they decay from the intro. They are out by the lyric time again. Drums, bass, and clean stereos are strumming with some, what I'm calling, in between single note playfulness here. The bass tone's ripping. The bass, where the bass sits in this is really interesting too. It doesn't hit you in the face. It has its own place kind of back here, but it's really big. And on the line, because there's a hunger, a longing to escape, an organ panned off right swells in here. Kind of sounds like a Leslie. It's really buried, but what a layer.
'Cause there's a hunger, a longing to escape from the life I live when I'm
old. Yeah, you know, I can't even remember that layer, to be honest with you. We're going down memory lane. I don't know what John would have used.
Mark, I've never heard it before. I've heard this song hundreds of times. I've never heard this until I got in headphones and really listened. I'm like, wow, there are some overtones. I think it's a Leslie or something. It is so cool, and it builds.
And back in those days, you couldn't break out your laptop and just have a synthetic version of it.
Right.
You got to have a Leslie, a real thing.
In all fairness, when you went back home for the night, that could have been John sitting there doing a lot of this that you never even saw him track.
Yeah, it could have been. But I think he would have told us, unless we just forgot and we just saw him doing it. Hey, whatever he did, he knocked it out of the park.
It's there. Absolutely. Well, right there, we get into pre-chorus one. And pre-chorus one, I'll say it later somewhere in my notes here, but I'm going to make the argument that this is almost as catchy as the chorus.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sets it up.
It does. It's a moment.
So let's go there. Let's make our escape.
So let's go there. Let's make our escape. Come on, let's go there. Let's ask, can we stay?
Hey man, you want to stay out of that reality where you're flipping, like I said, where you're flipping burgers and you're living the dream, you know? literally living the dream.
That's awesome. Well, I'm calling it these menacing, chugging stereo guitars come in here and really separates this part from verse one. That organ is still present, panned off right, and it really adds a cool tension. On the last line, let's ask, can we stay? The guitar, kind of in the last chord, goes up this octave to launch into chorus one. Pre-chorus one here, the vocals sound doubled, Mark. They don't sound doubled in verse one. Is that where they might have got doubled?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you.
It's a tight double. It's not loose, but yeah. I can hear what sounds like some movement in there. Chorus one. Can you take me higher to a place where the line might see? Can you take me higher to a place where golden stream? Can you take me higher to a place where blind men see? Can you take me higher to a place with golden streets?
I would guess that that's a biblical reference of some sort, you know, because Scott had a very religious upbringing. You know, both of his parents were diehard church attendees. And Scott would tell me, you know, if he ever got in any trouble, he'd get sent up to his room to, hey, go study this Bible verse and give me a essay on what it means to you. So he's very well versed in every, you know, inside and out of the Bible. So that I think when somebody's going to write poetry of any sort, you're going to go with what you've studied and what you're familiar with. So that's, you know, a lot of what had to do with him referring to the Bible a lot.
Well, I always thought that hooks in a song had to be lyrical hooks when I was a kid. You know, oh, the hook is the chorus, right? But man, we get some hooks that aren't vocals here in chorus one, Mark. And it's after the first, can you take me higher? We get the, when I heard that, I was in my car when I first heard this song. We're going back 25 years. And when I heard that, I was like, that's when I was like, I got to peek behind the curtains here. There's some metal influence going on here. That's not a 90s alternative grunge riff or whatever you want to call it. What was happening during that time period. What was that all about? Did you just fly that in the studio, rip it at one point, and everyone liked it? It's such a cool part.
Well, you know, I was always the only guitar player, other than bass, obviously, in the band. So I was trying to fill out as much space as I could. I tried to keep it as interesting as possible without just strumming chords and try to tap little lead parts in with the rhythm parts. And, you know, I always picture myself on stage. What's going to be fun? Just strumming the chords or doing a little lick here and there and, you know, just try to keep it, you know, interesting.
How many hands you see in the air do the air guitar to that part?
Hey, you know, I hope I can see him next summer when we're back out there.
Hey everybody, don't go anywhere. We got lots more with Mark Tremonti coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, back to the show.
We go right into verse two. It's the same overall instrumentation as verse one, but there's a couple other things. Oh, I would like a world of change. It helps me to appreciate those nights and those dreams. But my friend, I'd sacrifice all those nights if I could make the earth and my
to let love replace
Although I would like our world to change, it helps me to appreciate those nights and those dreams. But my friend, I'd sacrifice all those nights if I could make the earth and my dreams the same. The only difference is to let love replace all our hate.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's could work better in these times. You know, it seems like the world's a jacked up place at the moment. And I think he's saying those lyrics, in reality, life is got its ups and downs. It would be great if it could all be, you know, these pie in the sky ideas or these dreamlike states you have that are perfection. And I would give up all those dreams if I could make it a reality.
The song's a really major positive, especially the lyric, but there's also kind of like a sadness to this song I get. Do you feel that? Like a desperation. And I don't know why it was such a positive lyric.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you hear like, you know, we need to replace all the hatred in the world, that's a sad thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on the line, it helps me to appreciate those stereo guitars, like verse one, they finally fade out. And then we get like a keyboard on the next line, those nights and those dreams. It's like an organ swell, just very subtle that happens. If I could make the earth and my dreams the same, a noodly organ, super buried comes in here. It's kind of swirling right and left. And when I say buried, it is just, you would almost never hear it cruising down the road with car noise.
The earth and my dreams the same. The only difference is,
you know, I'm gonna have to go back and listen now. You're turning me on to things I don't remember.
It is so cool. You're gonna trip out when you listen in headphones. Yeah. Put your AirPods on or something. It's really cool. The last line, to let love replace all our hate, there's an organ swell and it kind of does a slide, a finger slide on the organ to take us into pre-chorus too.
So let's go there. Let's make our escape. Come on, let's go there.
Same lyrics as pre-chorus one. At this point, why mess with the formula? You're not going to add any more information here. The words are perfect in the pre-chorus, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Don't overcomplicate it. We kind of did that later on in our career. If you listen to the song Time, which is, I think, our best song, I think we all agree Time on the Full Circle Records is the best song we ever recorded. But verse one and verse two have different melodies, which isn't very common.
No, that's a risk. That's a risk to take, but sometimes that's really cool. Yeah. And that's what you know, makes you talk about that song. Oh, the second verse isn't like the first. You know, with Scott being your primary songwriting partner in Creed, Mark, did you ever find like, you know, he'd bring in a lyric that you didn't like or didn't think felt the song? Would you talk about that, or was it just Scott's vision? Here's my music, and what's your vision with this?
No, I mean, when I worked with Scott, I would write the music, and then I'd write a lot of melodies as well, and I would throw out lyrics like on the first record, you know, What's This Life For? I wrote a lot of lyrics for What's This Life For? I wrote the lyrics to Torn, and then scattered lyrics throughout, and then Scott would take his lyrics, and in the early days, you know, no, it was, I thought we never second guessed anything. I think it wasn't until the only time I ever second guessed Scott's lyrics were on the Full Circle record when we were doing a song. It was the ballad, I think Walk Away in Silence it was called. And he started speaking in another language.
Whoa.
And I'm like, hey man, after his explanation of it, he's like, you know, that's how, you know, it was something I'm saying to my wife or this and that. I'm like, hey man, if it's a rock song, I don't care if it's Spanish, Greek, whatever it is, I think you need to just stay English. I think it's, I don't know, it's jarring. It was jarring to me, and he gave in, and he agreed in the end. But
well, I've never had that happen in my band. No one's ever come in and wanted to speak a different language. I'd probably have a difficult time with that too, Mark.
Yeah, you know, the only time I've ever considered it was Frank Sinatra does an incredible version of Ave Maria in Italian. Like, yeah, that would be fun. That'd be a good challenge. Unless you're saying you're speaking Italian and you say something stupid, and I'd have to have one of my relatives listen to it, make sure I'm not saying something wrong.
There you go. Well, pre-chorus two, same overall instrumentation as pre-chorus one, but the organ and more so its overtones seem a bit more present here in pre-chorus two, which I like because that's building the track, building the song. Chorus two.
Can you take me higher?
Can you take me higher to a place where blind men see? Can you take me higher to a place with golden streets? Same lyric. We get that guitar hook after Can You Take Me Higher. The lower bendy guitar lick on the second line. The guitar hook the third time. There's a great pinch harmonic off to the right. You were channeling your inner Zach Wilde there, I think, Mark.
There you go. Love me some Zach, for sure.
There you go. I love the pinch harmonic there. And then what I think is one of the coolest parts of the song is you go right back and it doesn't happen again. I love the placement of pre-chorus three. We don't hear it again. And like I said at the top, it's almost as hooky as the chorus, this part to me. It's a great setup for what happens next, which is the guitar solo. So let's go there. Yeah, let's go there. Come on, let's go there. Let's ask, can we stay? But this time on the first line, you get a let's go there from Scott that's echoed off to the left. Let's go there on line two. It's echoed to the right. And on line three, come on, let's go there. You get that whole line panned off to the left. And there's an arpeggiated organ part. I'm calling it the Twilight Zone part here, Mark. It's like do-do-do-do. It's like a three-note thing. It's buried again off to the right, a little more audible than some of the other parts, and it is killer. Those vocals that I was talking about with Scott a moment ago, they're kind of like filtered, like back calling responses. And interestingly enough, up to this point, it dawned on me. I said, where's the harmonies in this song? They don't happen until the bridge.
Right, yeah.
Do you recall talking about that? They wanted to save it till later? Because certainly there was room for harmonies in the choruses of this song.
Yeah, well, like you said, you know, it's building a song. It's you don't want to start at the top. You got to build up. So everything is just, you know, you're on this roller coaster to the top. But back then, you know, it wasn't the harmonies and the doubling and the vocals wasn't as prevalent as it had gotten over the years. So back then it was just stripped down and bare kind of compared to what bands are doing now in production. It's like even the Leslie layer in there isn't something that we did a ton.
Right. Yeah. Well, again, it's four guys playing in a rock band. That's what this sounds like. This isn't an overblown production. It's a really big production, but you can tell it's just still four guys in a band. The guitar solo comes in after pre-chorus three, and I can't state enough. I love that pre-chorus three doesn't happen again, but it does happen three times, as I feel it had to happen three times. Yeah. It's darn near as catchy as the chorus. Up high, I feel like I'm alive for the very first time. Set up high, I'm strong enough. Take these dreams and make them mine. Before the pre-chorus lyric starts, there's like this spaceship sound that happens. It's almost like a Tom Scholz from Boston Rockman, like when you turn that thing on full blast.
Well, I did have a Rockman. I had a bunch of little racks. Maybe I brought one in for the studio. Who knows?
I'm telling you, it sounds like this spaceship thing happening. It's such a cool way to enter into this bridge. And we get our first harmonies on very first time. They're subtle, but it's the first harmony in the song. We also get a vocal harmony on Take These Dreams and a vocal harmony on Make Them Mine. At the end of this section, these big octave guitars come in. They strike with the band. It's just like this whole part crescendos, and it really helps set up the next eight bars of what I'm calling a musical interlude before the second half of the bridge. Now, this part, I didn't A-B them that closely, Mark, but if I were to guess, I think this was another part that was clipped for the radio edit.
Probably. I mean, we had to find the places that didn't have vocals in any musical part and chop them in half. So yeah, I'm sure that that bridge got chopped in half.
But I went with the album version because I love this part. Yeah. I love that it dips down to this musical interlude, and then it comes back for the bridge before you get to the double chorus at the end. Again, you don't go back to that pre-chorus. We don't hear that again. So I think it's cool.
You know, when we play live, we're playing the radio edit because it's such a widely known version of that song. We're not playing the album edit like we normally would do. I don't think any of us even remember the album version.
So you're telling me I should have done the radio version. You got to come back. We got to do the radio version now, Mark. Yeah, jeez.
No. You know, it was like I said, it was so widely played and heard and performed. It's almost like the record version is just long forgotten unless you're a diehard that's listening to the actual album.
And isn't that funny how that happens? I mean, you couldn't help that the song sold 17 gazillion copies and became one of your signature songs. So you're going to play what the audience knows, right?
It destroyed the original version in a good way. Yeah. Sometimes you don't know better. You know, when we're recording a record, we're like, no, this is the way the song should be. And the record label's wrong. Radio folks are wrong. They're destroying our art. Hey, maybe they were right in this case.
I just read Geddy Lee's new book, and he has a quote in there. It says, mixing is the death of hope. And I'm like, what does that mean? I started to read it, and it was like, yeah, when you're recording, you're hearing all these overtones and these parts, and they're pushing your vocal up. And now when it's mixed, it's like, where'd my part go? I need the guitars louder. You know that fight. We all go through it.
Oh, yeah. We've had that many a times. I remember when we did the only time we had to have a slight disagreement with John Kurzweg was on this record when we did the song Faceless Man. We have the beat on an offbeat, and he put it on the beat on the one, and we're like, wait, no. He's like, no, it just sounds wrong. We're like, no, it's just the way the song is, and we kind of battled over it. Finally, we got our way, but Faceless Man is another one of those songs that we think is probably the second best song we've ever done, and I'm glad we stood up for ourselves.
Sometimes you gotta stick the producer in the corner and say, no, we're right. Yeah. And sometimes we are right. This second half of this bridge, this musical interlude, it's reminiscent of the very top of the song. We get an O-O at the end, kind of this delayed thing off to the left by Scott, another O-O to the right. And then the O-O the third time becomes centered. And that echoes into the lyric, set up high, I'm strong enough to take these dreams and make them mine. However, we don't get any harmonies here on the vocals. Clean strum stereo guitars come in for this part, single bass notes and sporadic hits on the ride cymbal. And make them mine. After that lyric, there's a cool swell into these big stereo guitars and a huge drum fill that takes us into chorus 3, and we get a guitar slide in right there off to the right. That takes us in for this double chorus.
Can you take me higher to a place with lightning and the sea? Can you take me higher to a place with gold and the streets? Can you
some cool things happen here, and I have a feeling you're not going to know. I was going to kind of quiz you. You're not going to know. You haven't listened to this in forever. Double chorus, right after Can You Take Me Higher, we get that guitar hook, and man, there's a really killer, busy bass run. I say busy, not in a bad way, that happens right after that line. Doesn't happen elsewhere in the song. It's killer. To a place where blind men see, we get that lower bendy guitar part, and on Can You Take Me Higher, the third line, guitar hook comes back in. This time it is a crazy squeal pinch harmonic off to the right.
You gotta build the song, man. You gotta have the biggest one at the end.
There you go. I'm glad you saved it, Mark. And then the second half of the chorus, again, the lyric is exactly the same. After Can You Take Me Higher, the guitar hook happens. We get a harmony, vocal harmony, onto A Place Where Blind Men See. It's a really loose vocal harmony, but on that line, on the second line, doesn't happen anywhere else in the song, we get the high guitar hook again.
Yes, sir.
And then it happens on the third line, and there's a guitar hook. And the last line, To a Place with Golden Streets, we get a vocal harmony on that as well. The band ends here, and on the fade out, you get a super high guitar harmonic panned left, and you can really hear that organ part trickle off to the right, and the song ends. You know, you wouldn't hear these layers again driving down the road or jogging, listening to it, or just casually hearing it in a bar or a restaurant or wherever you're going to hear this song. When you sit with headphones and listen to the overtones of what's going on underneath the band, it's really, really cool.
Awesome, man. Well, I need to do that. It's been a long time. And I haven't put on a lot of Creed records until we started announcing the tours. And then I think we were at the beach, had a party, put some music on. I was like, oh man, forget about this track. We're going to have to pull these out.
And isn't that weird? And you go back, and have you ever struggled? Have you ever been like, how do I play that? Because I have. I've went back and like, what am I doing here? A lot of times the part will get buried.
I have to. Nowadays, when I write a song and an album, I have a file on my computer that tells me exactly how I play everything. But anything, anything before Ultra Bridge 3, I have to relearn again by ear. So it's a task. You know what I do a lot of times is I'll get on YouTube and say, how do I play What If by Creed?
I was going to say, you know, when I'm, you know, I like to pick up a guitar and go through songs on here. And sometimes I don't know what's going on. It's like above my skill set. So I'll go on YouTube and man, you just start getting, okay, this guy butchered it. It's wrong. I could hear off the bat, this guy's wrong. Yeah. And finally you'll find the guy. It's like, okay, he knows what's going on.
Absolutely. But it's very helpful.
Yeah, sometimes you have to dig. Well, listen, thank you so much for carving out some time to sit in here today. I nothing but respect, man. You're just out there working year after year. I'm stoked to see what happens with the Creed reunion. I know it's going to be huge. I've mentioned a lot of what you got going on, but before we break, anything else you'd like to leave the listeners with? Here's your shot.
Well, since since we're right around the corner from Christmas, I just put out a Christmas record with the guys I recorded the Sinatra record with, and plus 23 stringed instruments and a percussion session and a choir. So it was a lot of fun. That just came out. It's called Mark Tremonti Christmas Classics New and Old. Like I said, we got a show here this Saturday performing it. So I'm really excited about it.
I'm not laughing to laugh. I'm smiling. I mean, yeah. It's great that you're doing that. It's a different look and it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I got into the Sinatra thing. I was singing Christmas songs and like, you know, this lower stuff really suits my range better than the rock singing high all the time. So yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. So hopefully I can do volume 2 one day.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me.
I can't believe how much Mark sounds like Frank Sinatra on these songs. Go check it out. It's incredible. And I hope you all enjoyed this episode, but don't go anywhere. We got lots more Chris Demakes a Podcast coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gourley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Pure Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, email your best song and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Run Motor Run, a five-piece high-energy rock band from San Francisco, California, that blends punk rock, Scandinavian rock and roll, and early 90s grunge. Interesting mix, and they most likely have that market cornered. You can find their music on all the streaming platforms. Here's a snippet of their song, Organisms.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Chris, I'm glad we finally got Mark on the show. We've been trying to get him for a long time. And I got to say, it's pretty inspiring to hear that these guys went from working at Chili's and Ruby Tuesdays and a knife store at the mall to being one of the biggest rock bands.
Yeah, you know, they got a lot of hate, whether people think it was deserved or not. What Mark said is true. They were just four knucklehead college buddies that were playing in a band. They record this record in between flipping burgers at their buddy's house that ends up getting picked up by a subsidiary major record label, remixed, thrown out there, and becomes one of the biggest selling debut albums of all time. Basically, a demo.
Yeah. And hey, as far as the hate goes, you got to be something to be hated. If people are indifferent to you, then you're not doing anything right. You know, if you have a lot of haters, take that amount and multiply it by like 5, 10, some number. That's how many people that love what you're doing. Hey, I love the impromptu in the moment style of writing this song. Did they say that they were at sound check when they just started riffing?
Yeah. You know,
to write this song?
You got to think, I mean, after the first record, they just were thrusted into tour mode. They were out there. So where are you going to write songs? The back of the bus or at sound checks? So yeah, kind of makes sense, but they weren't demoing. That was interesting. They didn't really have the means to demo. When he said they kind of would send stuff around, it was probably a cassette. Like, hey, check out this riff. Can you write some lyrics over it, Scott?
Right. Hey, do you guys in Less Than Jake ever get the opportunity to like work on songs on stage at soundcheck? I mean, you guys have some longer sound checks when you're headlining. Do you ever do that?
We do. We filmed a couple videos at soundcheck in the past couple years. We did one for the last track on Silver Linings, our record from 2020. There's a song called So Much Less that we recorded. It's funny. We recorded it at the Marquee out in Tempe, Arizona, and came back and recorded our Come Dancing live portions at the same venue about a year later. So yeah, we take the liberty of sound checks to work on stuff sometimes.
You can't get a much better, I don't know, environment. It's kind of inspiring. You're in this venue and you have all your best equipment and maybe you have your in-ears running. It just seems like an ideal environment. I'm just never in that environment where I have hours long sound checks. I'm in a practice space when we're writing, but I think that's pretty neat. That's a pretty neat way to write songs. I also think, you know, when you're going back to this time and you're recording to ADAT, they didn't record this to Pro Tools. There's something beautiful about recording with a set of limitations to a certain extent. And every step of the way, knowing you don't have the luxury of, oh, we're going to go back and fix that. Don't worry about that. For right now, that's just a placeholder. What you're doing is what has to be there. I mean, I think that's actually really cool.
Well, you're making yourself a better player. You know, I've always said there's no way in the 70s, 80s, even now, like really good session players, they don't come in and take 30 takes. They come in and kill it. That's what they do. And I was never that good. I'm still not that good. I have to really work at playing guitar. And, you know, we'd make recordings back in the day and they would get done. It's like, okay, now I have to learn how to play this. You know, right. what parts am I gonna omit that don't need to be there? I can't play three guitar parts at once that I layered. What's going to be the forefront live?
Dude, that's so funny. I've been doing that lately. We have some punchline shows coming up where we're playing some songs that we haven't played in a decade or never played. They were album tracks that we never played. And I have to go back and be like, what am I playing here? What am I doing? And I think it's so funny that both Mark and you said that at some point you've gone on YouTube to find some kid that's playing it on there and be like, oh, that's what I'm doing. I think that's pretty inspiring for all the YouTubers out there making the how-to videos. You know, I love watching a good how-to play something video on YouTube.
Yeah, I've had to research my own stuff, other band stuff before, and you'll find some bad videos, incorrect videos, not bad, very incorrect. But sometimes you'll stumble across, like I said, like, oh, this guy's got his act together. But man, you talk about, you know, the old sophomore slump. It didn't happen to these guys. I mean, and it sounds like they didn't have much time to think about it. They went from the tour straight into recording the next record. And Mark didn't have an answer. I'm still a little bit perplexed why they would have buried the arguably one of the biggest songs of their career, number 9 out of 11, back when you would forefront the album. Well, you know, you'd put the top songs up in the front of the album.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess it doesn't matter to the radio and like where it is on the album, and I guess maybe we overthink that, you know. Mm-hmm. At this point it really doesn't matter, to be honest. In the days of streaming, I don't know if you noticed this, Chris, but unless you have some giant massive single, whatever is track 1 on your album is probably going to be the one that gets the most singles now. So you better really front load your album if you believe in a song now. You know, we used to be pretty artsy about it. I think we, in my band, we still kind of are, but I think as we're about to finish a new album, we better think hard. Like, we better put whatever the best song is first, because that's the one that's going to get the most streams. And speaking of first, Chris, it's the first of the year. Happy New Year.
Something I didn't even say to Mark. Happy New Year. This is the first episode of the year.
2024. We made it. I like that it's an even year. That feels lucky, right?
It does. It does. I think it's a leap year as well. Is that correct?
Yes, it is a leap year. And if you're thinking about taking the leap into joining the Krista Makes a Podcast supporting cast, now's a great time to do it. If you love the show, if you love what we're doing, and you want to get bonus episodes and an enormous, like, year's worth of back episodes where you learn about music, you have some laughs, you learn some stuff. It's just a great supplementary episode to each week's episode. You can go to KristaMakes.com to sign up for a supporting cast. It's the perfect time to do it.
That's right. Thank you for supporting what Chris and I absolutely love doing. We got a lot of great stuff planned for 2024. Give us a follow on Instagram. We have a Krista Makes a Podcast Instagram page. We just started it. Chris, man, you've been throwing up a lot of really, really cool videos up there. A lot of cool content, so go check that out. Also, the Krista Makes official YouTube page. Go over there and peruse that. Chris has been in there as well, putting up a lot of great content. And also give Chris a follow on Instagram at Less Than Chris Fafalius? No, at Less Than Chris D. That's me.
Do you want me to make at Less Than Chris Fafalius? I mean, I'm a fan.
Me too. Give him a follow at Chris Fafalius, not Less Than. And yeah, go over to our Facebook page and join the Facebook group. Chris, there's like 5,300 members in there now. I can't even believe it.
Yeah, we have a good time over there. We're just tackling every corner of the internet with Krista Makes a Podcast.
That's right. No stone unturned. And also, before I forget, because how could I forget? It's how we end every episode. I want to thank this week's guest for sitting in with us, Mark Tremonti. And we'll see you next week.
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come, baby, come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast. Come, baby, come, baby, baby, come, come.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast.
I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Hello out there.
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Minahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!